Welcome to episode 139 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including Hide and Seek. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uosa. How's it going, Daniel?
Good, Mark. Not that long since we saw each other in person, playing a little Eclipse today, but maybe a little more on that later. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, very well. Yeah, relaxing weekend. It's nice to play games in person. It's been too long for that. So, yeah, we'll talk about that soon.
Absolutely. Well, we've got three courses of games coming up. We start things off with the appetizer. We talk about some news and game ephemera. What's on your mind lately?
I guess we can talk about the Pokemon event.
Yes.
We thought it wasn't coming because they were so quiet for so long. And then they finally came out with an announcement not too long ago. They announced a lot of things, including some little strange oddities. I couldn't follow half of the things.
Well, every spin-off game, like Pokemon Cafe and Pokemon Go and Pokemon Sleep, all got, you know, little add-on bonuses and
yeah,
upgrades.
I still don't know what Pokemon Sleep is. Of course, we covered a Pokemon trading card game extensively in a feature episode not too long ago. But of course, the big news was the mainline entries, the latest generation. I think it's called Winds and Waves.
Yes.
They haven't really clarified it, whether it's just Switch 2.
I believe so, yeah.
But it does look a lot more impressive than the recent ZA series, which is just limited to the very small urban center environment. This one is in kind of a lush area with winds and waves, as you might imagine. So looking good, but it's you're going to have to wait a little while longer because I think it's like 2027 at the earliest. Is that right?
Yes. I imagine it's probably coming out around the same time next year. Though, I mean, by that time, it will have been 5 years since Scarlet and Violet, which is the longest period between any Pokemon generations. It's only ever been 3 or 4 years between the previous, which doesn't seem, it feels like it's been a lot longer, but I'm glad they're taking a little longer, hopefully, to let that one cook, since Scarlet and Violet did feel very rushed in that big jump to 3D.
Right, and I think they're probably doing the wise thing of including the sort of spin-off Legends sub-series games. Mm-hmm. They're trying some things out. They're being experimental in those Legends. I think, what was it? Arceus was the first one to introduce some sort of open world style, kind of real-time capture sequences. And the latest one, ZA, like we said, is having that urban environment and seems a lot more kind of like dueling focused. And I've heard that there's like a just dueling app called like Champions or something like that.
I saw that was one of the announcements. I wasn't familiar with that game at all. There was that MOBA at some point. I'm not sure if that's still around.
Who can really follow these things? Apparently someone is. So happy for y'all. And then you were just mentioning a certain Pokemon-related hardware release. Do you want to tell the folks a little more about that?
Yeah, well, one thing that I hadn't seen talked about at all, but seems quite curious considering your talk recently of dedicated audio devices, is that they're releasing something called the Pokemon Jukebox, I think it is, which basically resembles a classic Nintendo Game Boy. It looks about the same size profile, but comes with like 40 cartridges, all of which look like Pokemon Red or Blue, but have like a screenshot. And so you sort of click it into the back of this device, it'll show a screenshot from the game and then play an audio track from the game. So I guess each cartridge is like a single audio track, which is, it's a novel idea. I mean, it's a lot of nostalgia for that music, obviously. It does seem like a bit of a waste having that many cartridges floating around. I'm not sure how you'd organize them, but it's a cute novel idea for those looking to enjoy like audio in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I first thought in the trailer when they were showcasing the hardware, I thought it was going to be related to the Lego Game Boy kit, which sort of showcased, they had like lenticular printing or something on the cartridges that showed the artwork behind it. And this one does something similar. Like it must be very, very small because the cartridges are tiny. I imagine they're on like little SD cards or something like that. Me personally, while I do like retro audio hardware, I'm not too much of a Pokemon fan. Like, don't hate it. I just don't have the natural nostalgia for it. So I don't know if I'll be collecting. That said, I may be visiting Japan for a short time this year, so I will try and hunt it out there. I'm sure it'll be all sold out anywhere around here physically as soon as it drops.
I'm remembering some device I had from my grandparents back in the day. I have no idea what it would be called, but it was like some kind of machine where you'd plug in a single, like a little cassette tape, and then crank the handle, and it would be, it's like the player piano, and it would just play, like each cartridge was one song, and you'd crank it a little bit, and it would play, you know, Pop Goes the Weasel or something, and then you pop that out, pop another cartridge in. It reminds me a little bit of those days.
That sounds kind of cool. Yeah, a little cartridge-based music box.
Nice. Yeah, one other announcement that I did was of interest to me was Procopia, obviously right around the corner. By the time you're listening to this, it'll be like a day away, potentially. They revealed some new characters in that. But one thing I'm sure a lot of people aren't particularly interested in this, but I like the look of, is like a hide-and-seek mode. Because everyone is playing Ditto in that game, you can basically turn yourself not into just Pokemon, but also like props, like rocks and barrels and things, which reminds me a lot of... Did you ever play a game mode called Prop Hunt?
No, I don't think I did. What game is that for?
I mean, I played it within the context of Team Fortress 2. It was like a custom fan server, and like one team, it was basically a team game. One team would like have a minute to go around and would spawn in as a random item, hide somewhere on the map, and then the other team was a bunch of pyros, and then would run around spraying fire trying to find them. And it was a really cute, novel little hide and seek game, but in terms of like trying to, a little bit like Hidden Trader games, like trying to blend in, I guess. That was a fun twist on that mechanic. And I think this just sounds fun, potentially something I'll play with my daughter.
Yeah, I think it is cool when multiplayer games try and break out of the typical deathmatch or capture the flag type of modes. I think there are some games like, Splinter Cell, I think, had a sort of like...
Yeah, Terrorist Hunt
or something? Asynchronous mode or something like that, where one side was going to sneak and the other side was not. And I think Metal Gear Solid has always had some sort of sneaking modes where you could pretend to be an object or this or that. And if I'm not mistaken, the single-player game Prey has like an alien that transforms into objects as well. So that kind of sounds reminiscent also. And I'm just... I'm not remembering the other example of another one. I think it might have been that Ubisoft game. Oh, is that one? The one with the hackers.
Oh, Watch Dogs?
Yeah, Watch Dogs had a multiplayer mode,
I didn't play that.
I didn't very much either, but where you could play like NPCs and whatnot.
Oh, so. Assassin's Creed had that mode where you spawn in as a random NPC and you had to try and assassinate each other while blending into the crowd, I guess, as well.
Yeah, I think that's sort of cool, and Procopia, I guess, lets you have a taste of that in much more PG-rated, though.
Well, in the meantime, everyone's very busy memeing on those new Pokemon starters, trying to figure out which one's going to turn into some weird humanoid-looking thing, which one's going to turn up really sexy. I don't know, we'll have to wait and see.
Just leave it to Halloween. There's going to be some sexy Halloween Pokemon starter costume available, I'm sure.
Excellent. Any other news for you?
I think you were teasing that for your recent birthday, you might have gotten some nice hardware. I'd like to hear a little bit more about that.
Yes, yeah, I had some things on my wish list, which I finally treated myself to. One of which is the 8-bit Do mechanical keyboard. It's been out for a year or so, and I think there's a few different versions, but this is particular one is like designed around the NES, the sort of very gray, black, and red design. Very much looks like something like out of 2001 A Space Odyssey 2. So just great retro vibes. It is my first time with a mechanical keyboard. I'm not sure if you can hear any of this ASMR, perhaps. but good clicky clacks. The other thing, weirdly, that it came with is what they call the super buttons. For those who can't see on the video, it's about the size of an old school NES controller, but it's just two giant red buttons that are like a couple of inches each wide that you can basically program to whatever you want. So I've been debating what to use those for. I know some people use it for like copy and paste. I've got one set to like screenshot of games right now, and I'll experiment with that a little bit. So that's a lot of fun. But yeah, fun experimenting with some new tech.
Yeah, for those who can't see, they look gigantic, like almost like the size of the Office Depot easy button or whatever that they have. Yeah. Pretty humorous to see in person. Okay, since you showcased some hardware, I'd like to do a quick rundown. I'm not going to take too long about this. for some audio hardware that I've been collecting recently. You mentioned I was into audio hardware, and yes, that is something I'm a bit of obsessing about recently.
The quest continues.
Yeah, these are not the players themselves, but just some accessories. So I'm going to showcase one of them right here. This is the. These are a pair of Bluetooth earpods. Earbuds, essentially. This is from a Chinese company called Moondrop, and they're called, strangely, Space Travel, not Space Traveler. They're called Moondrop Space Travel. And I wanted to point them out because they sound excellent. They use the LDAC Bluetooth transmission protocol, which is very high quality, very high resolution. And these are incredibly cost-effective. They cost about $30 Canadian to wow. acquire. So these do not break the bank. They sound great, and they look really nice in this stylish case, but I cannot recommend anyone buy them because they're super annoying. First of all, this case has no lid. Earbuds just drop in, which is kind of nice when you're putting them in, but when you're pulling them out, you have to just grab them with your fingernail from the edge or just deftly slide them out, and it's just not worth the extra hassle of potentially like losing them out
chasing them around the floor.
Yeah, I've had to buy like 2 third-party cases for this case because they didn't think to include a lid on this one. So nice try, Moondrop. I'm hoping for the next generation of that. Maybe they'll include a lid. Moving on quickly from there is my next piece of audio headset. This is an over-the-ear headset from FIO, or FIO, F-I-I-O. This is also another cost-effective audio solution. It is Bluetooth. You can see it's modeled after the old 1980s light over-the-ear style earbuds with a nice cheesy foam padding on the ear. Looks really cheap, and it is inexpensive. This will run you about $45 Canadian. Also using the LDAC audio format. Sounds excellent. These are maybe the best over-the-ear headphones I've ever purchased, and I've purchased ones that cost 3, 4, 5 times as much. And they have this nice little faux wooden dial at the edge, which you can click to adjust the audio volume. And they just sound super sharp. It's lightweight. It doesn't fatigue you when you're walking around the house. These are just fantastic for listening to music. The only thing downside to this is that it, because it's not closed on the back, it may spill out. Don't listen to this while you're next to your partner who's trying to sleep in bed or anything like that. They may get interrupted, but hey, I work from home, so I'm not going to bother anyone when I listen to my audio that way.
Personally, I can't. I just can't stand the feel of that foam directly on my ears. I have to have something around my ears. I know it's like this nails on the chalkboard for me.
This is super lightweight. Maybe I'm of that generation that's very used to that, but it's not a problem to me at all because it's so light. Also, last piece of hardware I'm proud to showcase is that this one right here, and this is not a new one, but it's a very, very old one. This is a Sony. Let's see here, circa 2009 Walkman NWZ S545 model. And this is a very, very lightweight, like it's like so lightweight. It fits in the palm. It's like 20, 30 grams or something like that. And it fits a whopping 16 gigabytes of music, which is actually a decent amount if you don't have a large music library. Yeah. Most certainly enough for your day. And I wouldn't say it's hi-fi audio quality, but it does the job. I pop in some cheap earbuds. Put that on. It's got a sleep timer. It doesn't have Bluetooth, but I just pop it on before I go to bed, just lull myself to sleep. And it's just perfect. Light, cheap. You don't care about banging this thing up. It's just brilliant if you want to disconnect and just listen to some of your favorite songs. So I like it.
Have you had that since back in the day, or is this like a newly refurbished thing?
This is a newly acquired piece from a local individual here in Vancouver. I got it on that Carrot app, second place market app, and this cost me a grand spanking $15 Canadian. So like I was trying to convey to anyone who's interested in kind of like offline digital music enjoyment, you can get into this at a really inexpensive rate, you know, retro hardware if you can. There's new cheaper devices, which I'll be talking about in the future, but it's really to get into easy to get into digital audio collecting nowadays.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm having fun. Anything else you want to showcase?
Yeah, well, I mean, if there's one thing you can set your watch by in games right now, it's Steam Next Fest. That's feels like it's always coming around again. I've been digging through that. Obviously, there's been plenty of articles and videos breaking down what's worth checking out. I always like digging into the weeds and really looking for those hidden gems. I did that last time and found one of my favorite games of the year, Digagun, which I have spoken about previously, and like no one has played or reviewed still, it seems. So I like digging through, and it's obviously it's very hard. Like something like 3,500 games included in the Next Fest, a lot of which obviously are, you know, AI slop or just asset flips basically. And the way it functions, I think, is like when you if you boot up the Next Fest on the first day, it's just going to show you a random assortment of those 3,000 games, and then over the course of a few days, it sort of starts filtering through what people are liking, what it would recommend to you. So I try to get you on the first day, and you're never going to see everything, but just get a broad overview of what's there to try out. And I've played about a dozen of these so far. Nothing has grabbed me as much as previously, but there are a few highlights I wanted to discuss. I mean, a couple of trends quickly overall. Obviously, as I mentioned, a lot of AI, even in just the some of it's immediately obvious just from the thumbnail. And there are a lot of disclosures for what it's worth, so I just avoid those. A lot of roguelike X, coin pusher, roguelike X crossword game. I literally saw one as I was just before we jumped on. What was it called? It's called Beyond Words, which is a roguelike spelling word game, but it's by the designers behind GoldenEye and Time Splitters, which was not a combination of words I expected to see. So I'm going to queue that up after we finish recording that, I think. But other issues I did come across was a lot of translation issues. I found a bunch that were just would boot up in the wrong language or just clearly poorly translated, and I'm not sure if that's a lot of automated translation or just things being rushed. Hard to say, but that does make things difficult to process. Also, I mean, this batch really did also just put to light how difficult it is for a demo to showcase itself. Because I'm usually only spending half an hour to an hour max on these, because either I like the game and I want to hold off and wait till the whole game's out, or it's not hitting and I want to move on to the next game. And so many of these games take forever to really show their highlights. There'll be a lot of narrative and tutorialization that is fine in the regular game, but you really want to get to the good stuff and show what is special about this game, especially when there's so many to try and feed through. So that's been tricky. Obviously, not every developer can afford to make a custom demo just for this, but you get one shot at making an impression. And if you don't hit that, people aren't going to come back and buy your game, most likely.
Yeah, I don't envy the indie game developers these days, especially if you're maybe a single-person development team. You don't have any marketing staff on hand or a social media team or anything like that to build your buzz. You know, you can't just be a game developer anymore. You also have to be the social media maven to just get the word out to even show above the fold of, the search results. So it's a little challenging. My heart goes out to all those, developers trying honestly and hard to get their personal piece to shine.
That is one of the real struggles of the, what's the term? I saw the deprofessionalization of the video game space. It's just everyone is doing everything by themselves, whether it's one or two people, and you can't be specialized. You have to be able to do everything, which makes it really tricky, obviously. But that said, a few highlights from what I did check out. The first one is Australia Did It. Obviously, that name immediately grabbed me, but this is by Rami Ismail, who a lot of people will know as one half of Vlambeer, who had made a very prolific studio back in the day. Also by Aesthetician Labs. So this is basically something of a tower defense game, but it's kind of split into two stages where you have you have a squad of soldiers that you place in basically this square. It's a pixelated isometric perspective. you have a square in the middle of the screen where your train is, and then like a rotating conveyor belt around that, and bugs will be coming in from the sort of the four cardinal directions. You're putting your soldiers on the perimeter to try and shoot them before they get to your perimeter, basically. And like, there's a few different, all of your characters have different attacks, like whether it's knockback or poison or direct damage, but then you can combine them and like fuse them into have like a wide variety of different abilities in some fun experimental ways. But you'll play that for a few rounds, this sort of turn-based tactical tower defense, and then you have to move on to the next node on the map. But before to get there, it actually zooms out to a whole other game mode where those same soldiers are now in your train traveling across the desert in real time, and like as these swarms of enemies come in, something like Starship Troopers, like these swarms of bugs, and your squad are now attacking the bugs in real time. And so you're using the same squad members with the same attacks, but now in a completely different context. And there is like this big element of like having to plan ahead, because like the soldiers who survive in that first game mode and how you position them in the train is going to determine how successful that real-time element is. And you do have some control. You can sort of focus their fire a little bit or have an ultimate ability. But there's these two game modes that are sort of bouncing off each other in some clever ways. There is a lot of information to read. I found it a little bit overwhelming. Some of that information isn't forwarded quite as much as I would have liked, but I didn't have a lot of time to spend with it, obviously. But that was that left a good impression.
That sounds hard to describe, hard to imagine.
A lot going on.
But interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Next one is Denshattack, which is by Undercoders. A lot of people would have seen this. I've seen some comparisons to something like Jet Set Radio. Basically, it's a grinding game. Like you are a train going down a track. It's always similar to what's it called? Temple Run, I think it was called, where you're basically running down a single direction. You just have to like turn or jump over obstacles, and almost like a rhythm game, you have to like grind or drift or jump over obstacles or switch tracks. But when you're in midair, you can do like kick flips and ollies like a skateboarder or something. It's very strange. It all has this sort of anime 2D, very punk rock aesthetic. And I don't have a lot of appeal. Like, I don't love games that are about chasing high scores or pulling off tricks. Like, I don't chase optimization in that sense, really. But it has a lot of style and pizzazz, and like, it's constantly changing what you're doing within the level, both exploring for collectibles or like avoiding obstacles and changing perspective, or like rolling on a giant Ferris wheel. So a lot of spectacle in that game, and a lot of style.
I can't imagine that either, but it also sounds interesting.
Well, perhaps something you can imagine is a little something called Vampire Crawlers. You were talking about Vampire Survivors just last episode. This is the latest game from that developer, Ponkle.
Yep, I have seen a trailer of this, so it does sound interesting. I mean, it has a lot of the familiar elements, like all of the same characters reprise their roles from Vampire Survivors, but the perspective is totally different, and I think the gameplay style is totally different, right? This is turn-based?
Yes, well, it's basically a first-person like dungeon crawler, like something like Wizardry. You're moving on a grid, first person in these dungeons, but then when you hit a battle, you're interacting with the game with a card based system like Slay the Spire. Now, what was really interesting about this is that at least insofar as I played, the cards are all very simple. You've got your knife card that will do 10 damage to every enemy on screen. You'll have your axe card that will do less damage but knock back some enemies, because like they're approaching towards the screen, and once they get there, they're going to damage you. You've got some, I can't remember what it was called, but a card that will do 10% extra damage for every card you play thereafter. And that carries across between turns. And so a lot of there was a lot of duplicates of your cards. So every deck might have five axes and five daggers. And so a lot of duplicates, a lot of simple mechanics that, so you're not really focusing on the individual numbers. You're focusing on the big macro picture of the strategy, because there were some other effects. Like if you play, the cards have a cost. You have like three energy on your turn, like Slay the Spire. But if you play cards in ascending order of energy, so if you play a zero cost card, then a one cost card, and a two cost card, you'll get like a damage boost. So it's very much zoomed out on that big picture of what you'll play. But because they're all duplicates, you know exactly what's in your deck, and you can very quickly get into a flow state, for better or worse, of clicking through immediately. And like Slay the Spire, I could never get to that stage of playing really fast. I wanted to sit there and think about each turn with a lot of intentionality. This is going to be very much vibe based of just quickly scan your hand, click, 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 get into that machine zone, which, again, I have railed against a little bit, but I can definitely see the appeal of that very immediate effect there.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine Vampire Survivors going turn-based. I think it's pretty much the opposite of that in the original form. It's just twitch and instant gratification. And turn-based naturally usually leans towards taking your time and strategizing. But, you know, I've seen games like Monster Train balance that sort of slow turn-based consideration with a big splashy kind of reward visually and, you know, in numbers that you get. So I'm sure that Ponkle has some surprises in store for us. And, you know, I honestly think the gameplay design of Vampire Survivors is very, very clever. So I think they'll show some surprises in the positive way here, too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's going to get complicated the deeper in you get, but you very quickly fall into a pretty fast rhythm for a turn-based game. And, like, there was areas, too, to explore and find some collectibles in the map, and they get some upgrades along the way. I didn't see much of the roguelike elements, but it seems like there's going to be a lot there.
Yeah, gotta wait till the full game comes out.
Yeah, a couple more quickly. Titanium Court. So this is like a match 3 game with some twists on it, where each time you match particular symbols, you get a resource that you can then spend to, like, send out units to both collect more resources or to attack enemies. And I feel like I've seen those mechanics in very similar twists on Match 3 in something like UFO 50. It doesn't feel particularly new there. What does feel new is the presentation. It's a fairly simple pixelated, like pretty low poly pixel artwork, but it all feels like this sort of Windows 95 pop-up sort of UI. Like, everything is these little pop-up windows, and it has an excellent sense of timing when it does. It'll pop up these windows for comedic effects, or this nice sense of timing. There's a lot of narrative that's coming through it. Like, you're in this weird, like, fairy court, but all the fairies have, like, they're like middle management in a technology company or something. It's very strange. So a lot of weird vibes going on, but a good sense of pacing and timing. The music, sort of the way it escalates and ramps up, with a great sense of pacing and a good sense of comedy in there as well. So I'm not sure how much, like, replayability is in the core mechanics, but if it keeps pushing through the narrative and story, at least, I'm definitely interested in checking more of that out. Okay, and finally, one last game I want to shout out is called Let's Build a Dungeon by Spring Loaded, who I think have previously done what called Let's Build a Zoo. And it's basically a simulation game where you're building your own MMO. And as far as I played, you're basically designing the map, like the town. You're going into the interiors of buildings and designing that into the dungeons. And, I mean, I don't have a lot of patience for designing and decorating games, especially for a demo. I'm not going to get that invested, but I can definitely see the appeal there. You're really getting into the nitty-gritty of both the world design itself, but then the quests, and, like, looking at the trailer, that you're choosing the people who are going to be working on the game and the marketing behind it. But you also have this element of, as soon as you start setting up quests, testers start coming into the game, and you're watching them run through like a little ant farm. We've spoken before about some of the charms of something like Oxygen Not Included. I've been playing a lot of Two Point Museum, and were I not already neck deep in that, I'd probably be a lot more interested in something like this. So maybe down the road, when I've got a little more time, I'll have a closer look at this.
Sounds very cool. All right, that was a full-on appetizer course. What do you think, Daniel? Should we move on into the mains?
Absolutely. Well, that's mostly what I've been playing this week is a lot of demos, but I do have some more tabletop to talk about. I mean, just quickly, before I let you talk about your game, Mark, I mean, we did play some more Eclipse today. We've talked about that in detail before, but it was a fun game. I mean, what were your thoughts today?
I think it felt just as fun as ever. I think that game is just the right size to pull out once a year. You know, mm-hmm. It takes long enough. It didn't take too long with, there was only 4 of us playing.
Yeah, we couldn't get a full group of 6 this year. This is like the 3rd year in a row where it's the birthday tradition of getting Eclipse to the table, which is always good fun.
Yeah, so that's just long enough where some people, like, forget their perfect strategy or whatnot. Mm-hmm. Others, like myself, remember their strategies. But it's just recent enough that people remember the overall feel, the flow.
It plays very intuitively.
Yeah, that's right. It plays intuitively, and the second edition copy you have, I guess the second
Second Dawn for the Galaxy.
Second Dawn for the Galaxy. Mm. It's really polished steel. There were a little bit of annoyances with the cubes kind of falling off one of the cases when you tried to move the lid. But it still plays super smoothly. I had a blast. Yeah, I think that's a great game, Eclipse.
Yeah, I played one of the newer expansions, something of Lyra, I think it was called. Like, it was basically these religious faction that I just set up shrines around the map. But it wasn't particularly unique, I will say. It didn't feel like there was adding much strategically or thematically, but I still had a lot of fun. It does feel like one of those games where you do have to improvise. You can't make a strategy in advance and stick to it. You've got to roll with whatever comes up. I was surrounded by pirates, and so had no choice but to really focus in on a pretty aggressive strategy, shall we say.
Yeah, I, on the other hand, did not test any boundaries. I went with a good old classic strategy, and somehow you guys let me run with it. Because
for the second time, you won as the plants turtling up. He keeps getting away with it.
You guys keep letting me do it. The plant, that is the strategy. If you can explore twice as fast, you spread out twice as fast. You turtle yourself up by closing off all the ways in to your part of the galaxy. And luckily enough, just my luck, no wormhole exits showed up in my area of space. So I was completely closed off, and somehow you let me run away with it. Got the bonus for 1 point for each territory I controlled.
Yes. Well, all had a lot of fun regardless. Go back and listen to some of our previous episodes. I know we both had it very high on our, I think it was like number two or three on our games of all time list as well.
Yeah, I think that game is continually fun. One of my faves.
Excellent. So what else have you been playing lately?
Yeah, let me cover, since we talked tabletop there, let me cover a video game that I've really just started to play, but I've gotten through at least one of the in chapters of, so I wanted to share how it's going. This game is a newer game. It's from 2025. The title is Urban Myth Disillusion Center. I always mix it up. I think it's Squad or something like that. But this is a Japanese developed and published, some would say, visual novel. Or is it a mystery, or is it an adventure game? Either way, it's a single-player, very visually stylistic game, and it's by publisher Shueisha Games, which is a subsidiary of Shueisha, which is the publisher of Shonen Jump, among other things. Okay. So they're more known for their books and their manga. And the developer Hakaba Bunko is not familiar to me, but I'm definitely curious about their creations. This game seems quite unique. So like I said, this one's a single-player game. I played it on Nintendo Switch, but it's also available on Steam and PS5. And in quite a few languages, too. I don't think there's any voiceover dialogue.
No.
But it's available in tons of written languages. English, Japanese, Korean, Chinese, of course. A bunch of European languages, even Arabic and Hindi. So if you got access to one of those platforms, you can check it out. So like I said, this game is very visually unique and stylish. It is true to the publisher's nature. The character designs, for instance, are quite, kind of stylized manga style in appearance. Very, Japanese. The game is set in modern day Japan and seems like very much of the moment. It doesn't seem like a retro game, even though the graphics are very, very prominently pixel-based. So there's these big, chunky pixels. The characters look pixelated, like right up in your face, even though everything looks quite sharp. It makes for a very kind of punk rock feel to it. But it's managing to pull it off very well here. So, like I said, the story is set in present-day Japan. Unlike another visual novel, which I covered recently, Steins Gate, I said that game has very little interaction and is very, very slow with its overall plot. This game is kind of like the opposite of that. It gets right into the action. It centers around the main character, whose name is Azami Fukurai. And she's a young woman who has visions, some sort of like telepathic visions.
Clairvoyance, they call it, I think.
Right. Yeah. She has clairvoyance powers, and it's always actually been a bother to her. She's always made her stand apart, and she goes to this agency, the Urban Myth Disillusion Center, to actually go and get help to kind of unravel her problem. But for one reason or another, she ends up kind of being like recruited by this center, and roped into working for them. It's this sort of like you, I don't know, you broke the expensive chandelier vase thing and now you owe us sort of trope that's very common in a manga. So the center director, who she meets right away in the tutorial mission, is a young man. His name is Ayumu Meguria. He has this like Professor X style, what's called hypervision. So he can observe things at a distance and is always kind of chatting in your ear, but is like communicating with you playing as Azami.
Like Professor X in a wheelchair seems like quite physically withheld.
Yeah, he's at a distance, but he's also kind of there giving you guidance along the way. So that's the sort of relationship. You know, thematically, this reminded me quite a bit of a manga that I enjoy, which has been converted into an animated series and a live-action movie called Mob Psycho 100. And I don't know if you're familiar with that,
Daniel. For the name.
Yeah. But if anyone's read or watched that, it's about this kind of telekinetic young person who goes under the wing of this older gentleman. In the case of Mob Psycho, the older gentleman is actually a shyster. He's like a fake. But in this case, Azami and Ayumu are both quite actually psychically capable paranormal individuals. But strangely enough, their role as the center is to dissolve these urban myths. So what are they supposed to do? Well, these sorts of scenarios come up, and then people go to them and say, can you explain why this is happening? Can you stop this from happening? It's kind of like the Ghostbusters, I guess. Who are you going to call? You're going to call the Urban Myth Dissolution Center. And ironically, your goal is to mostly poke holes into these urban myths and say, no, this isn't caused by the paranormal. There's a very real, very reasonable cause behind it. So it's a very kind of like detective story.
Even though there clearly are like very real ghosts and some kind of supernatural entities happening.
Well, there are
so it seems.
Visions, yes, okay. Certainly. Right. So like I said, it's a very real world setting. It seems very of the moment, very stylized. I'll continue to say that like a lot of the dialogue is in, you know, like close-ups of the characters' faces and that stylized 2D style, but unlike a lot of other visual novels, the characters are animated. You're actually seeing their changing facial expressions real time. You also see the characters represented on stages where they can move freely around back and forth, which is not very common in other visual novels.
It was exploring a little bit like a point and click adventure.
Very much like a point and click adventure. In fact, when you're on your cases, basically the structure is, you know, you talk to the boss, you get sent out on a mission, you go to the mission, and then you question the witnesses, and then you unravel things. Ultimately, there's going to be a sort of like, you've collected enough clues, and then you move on to like maybe a turning point, the sort of climax in the action, and then you pull everyone together, and then you have like a explaining period where you unravel the root of the crime, very much like your Knives Out mysteries.
So does it feel very episodic in that sense?
Absolutely episodic. Okay. I played through the one full episode and the tutorial, and it has a very satisfying conclusion to it. There's like a full explanation. There's a denouement, and then
I'm sure there'll be callbacks of some kind, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. This game is sort of set up to be like a series, and that much I like very much. So, like I was saying, there's the kind of like there's the kind of dialogue sequences, and then there's on the case. And when you're on the case, you're driven around by your companion, who's this young woman who has these like very prominent kind of Princess Leia bobs hair or whatever. And she's kind of standoffish, and she doesn't seem to have any paranormal powers. She's just kind of minding her own business and is a bit of a sounding board for your main character, Azami. And when you show up on scene, what's really cool, like I said, is that you get to control your character in real time over a map. The map is laid out like a very long room that can move back and forth, very much like a Maniac Mansion, like a very traditional old graphical adventure game. And what can you do while you're on the case? You do the basic things that you do. You walk up to various points of interest on the map. And unlike some of those old graphical adventures, like the points of interest are clearly laid out. There's like a big, hard to ignore, like square frame around every single clue. You can talk to every witness multiple times, and all the points of dialogue are clearly labeled off. So there really aren't many choices except in what order to handle things. Right. So in that case, it's quite visual novel style. So those are pretty standard. What's not standard is that because you have your paranormal powers, your clairvoyance, you can switch over into clairvoyant mode. You turn on these sort of like psychic glasses, and then you can see the other side. And when you turn these glasses on, you see these figments. And this is where, you know, you might have seen art in the trailers and whatnot of ghostly apparitions and things like that. But as the director of the Dissolution Center explains, these are not ghosts and the paranormal. These are visions of events from the past.
Like echoes.
Yeah, exactly. They're echoes that Azami can pick up on. And because maybe she wasn't there personally in the previous moments, she abstracts them into these kind of monstrous creations. For instance, there's this moment where a character is climbing and she sees a vision of that. But the character, the vision looks like a human centipede, kind of, with multiple arms and legs. So, of course, it looks very monstrous. And there's another moment where there's a character that's taking a photo, and it just looks like a creature with it one giant bugging eye. So it looks creepy, it looks spooky, and it's a little bit horror vibes, which I dig. It's really quite cool. But most of the interactions are very much typical adventure game. What's not typical is that you have your detective's notebook, which you have written down the basic information, the dramatis personae, whoever's involved, the individuals, little bios of them, a breakdown of the sequence of events that are connected to the case. And you also have a listing of likely urban myths that are at play. So this is kind of what sets this game apart from like a typical detective game, is that you're trying to connect the situation that's going on with a known urban myth. So examples are, and these are mostly Japanese, so these are Japanese folktales, urban myths that are popular there, like the man under the bed. So like the man under the bed comes out from under the bed and starts attacking you with an axe or something like that. Or the woman, the 8-foot tall woman is another example of a woman with a large hat. She's 8 foot tall and she seeks you out. Some of these urban myths overlap with other popular media you might be familiar with. I mentioned in a Dessert episode a while back, Dun Da Dun, which is that manga from Shonen Jump, also available in anime form. That one very much deals with the paranormal and urban myths. And some of the same characters cross over. These are kind of known
cases. They are known. They're not just invented for the game. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Funny enough, the game starts, the intro sequence of the game starts with a very Western nod. It has like a very X-Files type visual and audio kind of reference. But for the rest of the game, it's all Japanese stuff. So I thought that was an interesting touch there. Moving on from there, what is unique as well is the social media system. So I mentioned in games like Murder on the Marine Express and Steins Gate, which I talked about more recently, they're set in an urban setting. So you have a modern setting. So you have your cell phone with you. This game is no different. You have your cell phone and you very much interact heavily with social media. Or as the Japanese call it, SNS, or social networking sites. And what you typically do is you do like a rudimentary search based on the events of the case. And then you see like a message board thread, main post, and a ton of comments, like maybe like a dozen comments on each from a bunch of different posters. But what you could do is you can search through those posts and you can find hidden keywords, and you might want to use your psychic glasses, put them on, and then you can pull out individual keywords of interest, and then what pull those out into a separate notebook. And what do you do with those? You can use a search engine to look up those phrases. So this is related to what they do in Steins Gate, but a little bit deeper. This is like the next generation of that. So you can use an internal search engine to look up one or two of the phrases, of which you might have 7 or 8 on hand. So this is really interesting, because if it was just searching up the phrases one by one by one, that's not that innovative. But when you combine two phrases together, you get different results. Huh. So I thought that was quite cool and innovative and leads to interesting results. You see more social media posts, you see more keywords that pop out of those, and those slowly give you a clearer and clearer picture as to what actually is going on.
Is there much of an actual puzzle to solve there, or is it mostly just clicking through and reading, processing?
There is. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's too difficult. I would say that if someone is thorough and they clicked on every single result, they will eventually find out the problem. But unlike a lot of visual novels, you can't just click forward and advance. You actually do have to connect the pieces. Otherwise, you will be prevented from moving forward.
Just draw the red string between these two points.
Yeah, all this stuff is clearly laid out, so they don't make it hard. But you do actually have to make some leaps of logic. And in this next example is maybe what separates this game from a visual novel to a full-fledged adventure game. So periodically throughout your investigation, you will be taking these notes down in your notebook, and it'll say, well, what's the deal with the motive of this character? And then you will have this sort of quiz. And then this quiz is very, very short. It says something like, why did the assailant appear? And it says, it did blank so that blank to blank. So it'll have a phrase where you have to drop in three little prompts.
Reminds me of something like Return of Obra Dinn. It's like, how did this person die? Or who killed them with what, basically? Or like Clue, I guess, for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very much like that. But what it does is it gives you like 9 different options to choose from. So 3 prompts, 9 different options. You have to get them in the right order. Like, it does actually take some logic, follow through, and you paying attention.
Stay engaged with the story.
That's right. Yeah. So it's you can't sleep on this. You actually have to think about it. And they are very gentle if you get it wrong. For instance, if you got 2 out of the 3 right, they'll let you leave the ones that are right in order.
Okay.
So I'm not saying that it's rocket science or anything like that, but there is some thinking involved, and that much I appreciate. And that probably crops up maybe like 5-6 times within a case. And definitely when you get enough evidence collected, the director of the center will call you and he'll give you another quiz and you have to put it all together. And eventually the first case I completed was actually a little bit more complicated than I thought. I sort of like completed the first part of it, and then there was like an epilogue where further twists happened. So the story didn't go exactly the way I thought it would, and there was some unexpected results, and that epilogue was definitely a little spine tingling and worth staying for. You got, it just turned into a totally different genre from a detective story into, let's just say, like a horror story and revenge story. And here's where I need to give a few warnings, content warnings. So this being a modern story touches upon a lot of very modern situations. In the first case alone, it touched upon murder. And it also talked a lot about sex trafficking. It talked a lot about stalking. So, you know, these are not very light topics, and these might be some triggering topics. So I want the listeners to be aware of that. But I feel like the inclusion of such realistic kind of subject matter and modern subject matter, especially with the delivery with the social media and whatnot, felt very, really, really of the moment and authentic. And definitely touching upon like the horrific and the spooky thriller side of things, it came across done really well.
Especially through the lens of social media, there can be a certain level of detachment from how it's discussing those topics, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. For instance, in the first case, your character, Azami, has a personal connection to the victim. She knows the victim. So she sort of steps up for the victim in social media herself. She can't stop herself from standing up for the victim. And then you get to see the social media pundits giving their feedback about her comment, not knowing that she's personally involved. So you get to see some of the dirty side of things. So there's some uncharitable comments, let's just say, about everything that's going on. So I thought the first case was really solid. And each case, even the tutorial, when it completed, it has like a very, very satisfying, like, come on, you know, the director's talking to you. Come on, Azumi, put it all together, line it up for us. And then when you tee it up, you just like feel really good. You see like these literal puzzle pieces locking into place. And it really comes to a satisfying closure.
And how many cases are there, do you know?
I don't know how many cases there are. The first case that I completed took me about maybe two hours.
Okay.
So it's not a minuscule amount. And if this was a complete game, I would actually feel quite satisfied with it. Just because this game looks great, super stylistic, the writing is really sharp, feels like just like a really good, like a thriller manga or anime, right, of the moment. And this game is also really inexpensive. It's like $23.50 Canadian right now, I think full price. So this game can be had at for a song, like less than $20 US. And also, the soundtrack's really good. The soundtrack is really great. You can go listen to it right now on Apple Music, as I discovered. There's actually a vocal track you get to hear after the first case is resolved. So really, really sharp and kind of moody. I think this game is a winner. And I'm not the only one. This game has come away with a lot of awards. It got the 2021 of the 2025 Japan Game Awards, and also at least the PlayStation Partners Indies Award as well. So this game has come away with some kudos.
Yeah, I'd not heard about this game at all until I started seeing it popping up on a lot of end of the year, game of the year lists in 2025, basically. A lot of big names. I think it might have been Hideo Kojima or someone like that had listed it as one of their favorite games.
Yeah, I think this game is a winner, and I've heard of it talked up on like the IGN games, the Japanese IGN games podcast, the Shibitsugi Gamer podcast there as a title to look out for. I was very pleased to see that it was in English as well. So I think I bought it on the Japanese store, but clearly you can get it in English as well. I think this game is a winner, so comes recommended. This is the Urban Myth Disillusion Center from 2025.
Yeah, I played about 5 minutes of the demo just to get a quick vibe check, so no particularly in-depth thoughts, but it definitely was very quite stunning visuals up front in terms of being very low poly muted color scheme, but then very using highlights very cleverly, like your little red, like the red traffic light or the red ghost sort of popping out from the rest of the scenes in quite vibrant ways, and obviously playing with a lot of sort of creepypasta, all these sort of backroom myths, like liminal spaces, and like this unknowable, unexplainable circumstances. So obviously a lot in the water right now. So yeah, definitely see the appeal.
Yeah, they do a lot with a little in this game, and like you said, it's very like muted color palettes, maybe like three colors in a scene or something like that. And you see the two characters driving on the way to a case, and it's at nighttime, and you see the lights flashing over their faces, but they're not polygons, right? They're just pixels, but somehow very artistically in very few frames, they get across a very moody scenario. So I think it's very artistically done. I really like this one, and I'll definitely be continuing my plays of it.
Excellent. Yeah, I'll try and find time to poke it up some more myself.
Cool.
Excellent. Well, a game I've been wanting to talk about for a few weeks, getting back to the tabletop side of things, that is Animal Rescue Team. Came out just last year in 2025, designed by Matt Leacock and Lisa Tao, art by Jeff Langevin and Alyssa McCarthy, published by Play to Z, which I think is like the new imprint from like Z-Man Games. There's been some, I don't remember the exact arrangement, there's been some shakeups that publisher there. But a lot of people might recognize this game as a re-implementation of one of Matt Leacock's older designs called Thunderbirds, designed on that old TV show. Was that something you were ever familiar with, Mark?
I know of the, you know, the kind of legacy of Thunderbirds. It's very much like marionettes, right?
I've seen the parodies.
Yes, British marionettes-based action series was the inspiration for Trey Parker and
Team America.
Team America. And I think there's a lot of like Japanese action tokusatsu series that utilize marionettes as well. So I wasn't a super fan, but I've heard of it.
Yeah, I know that that board game had a strong reputation. I never had a chance to play it myself. It's pretty quickly went out of print. But basically, this is re-theming it around rescuing animals. Like, you set in this town. It's split into these sort of, I think it's 10 to 12 zones. They're sort of spread around. It's not like a grid map. It's like very organic, odd shapes, like bridges and islands and like weird arrangements. But it's set out very organically, and animals are spawning around this map, and you are playing one of six characters going around to try and rescue them. But it's not so simple as just going to the animal and rolling a dice. You have to actually manage the logistics and equipment, in that you have six vehicles and six equipment tokens, and so you have to physically move across the map in a vehicle that all have their own movement speeds. Certain animals need particular vehicles or will give you bonuses with the particular vehicles or particular items, and so everything is this logistical puzzle where there might be a cow on the islands, and the cow only fits in the trailer, but you need to move the trailer, you got to hitch it to a truck, and the truck's on the other side of the map. But you could use the boat to get there yourself, but then you need someone else to meet you there with the trailer. A lot of like weird, a lot of fringe edge cases and exceptions to how you're going to do this, and a lot of factors are taken into account with trying to optimize your movement. But it is a very fun logistical puzzle that reminded me of something like Into Deep. It's an underrated game that I really enjoyed, in which you were sort of moving these puzzle pieces, trying to get everything into position to fire off these objectives. And there is something immediately appealing to that, obviously, like especially with the theme. Like, it's very easy to get invested in, like, you know, no mouse left behind. There's a bunch of cards that all have unique settings and descriptions of what is happening to these animals. They're all like, if not named, at least have a description of the circumstances. So you can sort of invest a bit of like emergent storytelling into this, obviously. So when you get the right truck with the right equipment to the island to rescue the cow, you then got to roll these dice. And you need those. You need to hit a certain threshold. It's a little different for every card. Sometimes those will get harder the longer you leave it. But you have to hit a certain number with these dice in order to rescue the animal. But even then, you have to move that vehicle back to a shelter to get them out and make room in the trucks. Everything has this great physicality. Like, it's not just an abstracted moving things around the map or having resources in your hand. Like, everything is on the board and you're physically pushing it around and seeing the effect, the cause and effect of your actions. So I found that really appealing. The vehicles themselves are very big, chunky vehicles. They're quite large. They are like gray plastic, which isn't necessarily a bad thing in itself, but with the scale of them, they are a little simple. I'd like to see a little more detail or color there. It's a bit disappointing. So the opportunity to paint them, obviously, but as it is, it's a little boring with these big hunking gray plastic slabs. But otherwise, there's a lot of animal meeples, quite a wide variety of animals, cats, dogs, farm animals. A tiger somehow is in there. So really enjoyed all that. The trick is rescuing the animals themselves is not actually your main goal. You will have a goal, you will have a main objective card that might be something like, get these two pieces of equipment to this location and then spend these two resources. And rescuing the animals is really just there to let you get those resources and equipment. Rescuing the animals is really just there to help you get those resources to then empower you to fulfill those objectives. Those two elements are quite unrelated, and it's quite easy to get distracted from those main objectives. Like, the main fun of the game, the theme is all in the rescuing those animals, but really they're just there to get you these resource tokens. And like these tokens, you can use them to reroll dice or to take an extra action, for example. So they all have uses, but some of them you'll need to hoard in order to like sort of spend in for these objectives. I do think it's a weird dichotomy there. I don't think those primary objectives are particularly fun or like tied into the that core theme particularly well. Like, it's not, you're not engaging in the fun part of the game to do it. They feel like a bit of an afterthought. The primary goal to be a little more tied into the animal side of things, perhaps. And it can feel a little random. There are a lot of opportunities for luck to sort of cascade for better or worse, but mostly for worse. Because it feels like the only way to really succeed here is you want a few easy rescues. Like you want, like, is a cat stuck in a tree? You only need to roll a two. But that will give you a couple of dice reroll tokens. And then you can use those to start fulfilling some of the harder rescue objectives. And so there is a sense of you can ramp up. But if you get a whole bunch of hard animal rescue cards immediately, it's going to be very hard to crawl out of that. We had one case where there was a mouse. I can't remember where the mouse was trapped. We had to rescue this mouse because if we didn't, it was going to fall off the bottom of the track and we would instantly lose the game. So I spent my whole turn trying to rescue this mouse, failed both dice rolls. So then one of my friends had to come in and try wasting his whole turn trying to rescue this mouse, and we just kept flubbing the dice rolls, basically. And so it felt like that movie Mouse Hunt, basically, where we were just foiled constantly by this single mouse and just all down to the luck of the dice. And so it feels a little bad when it's a very binary fail state, basically. Like, you roll the dice, either you pass or you fail, essentially. So there is some mitigating factors, but if you're not given the opportunity to get those reroll tokens, for example, there's not much you can do. So we had a lot of failures that just felt like bad luck cascading. And obviously all of Matt Leacock's games have had an element of that since, you know, pandemic. This just feels like there's a few too many factors going into how the opportunities might cascade. Like, if you get three cards in a row that all need the boat to give you a bonus, and those animals are all on opposite sides of the map, it's going to be hard to make the most of that, unfortunately. So, yeah, I think this is a really solid concept and theme. Like, my daughter really enjoys playing this. Like I said, great sense of physicality. But the win state and the luck isn't quite integrated in the way that I've found satisfying, unfortunately.
All right. From your description, I can definitely tell it's based on Thunderbirds. Thunderbirds, the vehicles are sort of like main characters.
Yeah, themselves. I can definitely see how that would have worked well. Yeah.
Very cool. All right, Daniel, what do you think? Should we move on to our dessert course?
I think so.
Let's do it. All right, shall I go on talk about mine?
Please do, yes.
Okay. The one I am going to cover, I just finished reading yesterday or today. It's the manga of Akira, which is familiar to lots of people because they made a very, very famous anime film based on this. Like, very, very huge. If you haven't
seen that. I've not seen that, but I've seen the stills and, like, the iconic images from it, yeah.
It's absolutely epic. It was pretty much, like, the definition of cyberpunk before, you know, the cyberpunk video games came out. Still really influential to this day. I had never read the manga of. And this is sort of like the film sort of follows along the plot of the first volume of Akira, the manga. And then the manga continues on. There's at least, I think, six volumes of it, if I'm not mistaken. And it was serialized at one point. This was originally serialized in Japan from 1981 to 1993. So count that. That's 12 years it took to go through this 2,000 plus page series. So it's quite considerable. And the film could only capture the first volume of it. So I had known that, but I guess I just felt a little bit of trepidation. Oh, this is going to be super complicated and a big deal. So it took until recently to get through it. And then I blasted through it in a couple of days. It's really easy to read. It's basically all action. And that essentially follows the plot of the first volume. When I was watched the film when I was younger, I guess I was like in my 20s or late teens or something like that, I thought it was super complicated and very difficult to follow. And it's really interesting to read this because it couldn't be more straightforward. The plot was actually very simple. And I don't know what it was that got me trapped up in my mind, because this is sci-fi. It's set in, I think, in the year maybe 2029 or something like that.
I'm guessing it does have a lot of technical terms and jargon and things, like a cyberpunk story.
It does have some, but this plot is actually very easy to understand. Mm. It could be set in 1989. Like, there's no reason why it has to be set in 2029, except that this was the vast unimaginable future that is so far away from when it was originally released. Yeah, so this is ironically happening before the 2030 Tokyo Olympics. So reality beat it by 10 years. But this is happening 38 years in Tokyo after it was destroyed in World War III. So events, you know, have obviously diverged. The main plot features around this biker gang, which I don't remember, but is a gang of 15-year-olds. The gang is 15-year-old hell-raising biker gang. Well, at least they are in the manga. Maybe they were aged up in the film. Anyways, I don't need to explain the whole film. It's just to say that the plot is actually a lot thinner. It's really more focused on action and kind of nuance. And the art is really evocative. It's very kind of like technical, but the framing is innovative. It reminds me a lot of the artwork of Masamune Shirow, who did Ghost in the Shell. Very like technical drawings. You can tell that this person is like a creative, but also has like appreciation for engineering. Like the perspectives, the framing, very, very good. Like there's this sequence in the sewers, and strangely enough, the architecture of the sewers like is very, very evocative. So there's so much going on here, but the plot is not hard. It's just some weird stuff going on. The main characters, a few gripes. I feel like the two main characters, Kaneda, who's the protagonist, doesn't have a lot of personality other than he's a bit of a, you know, like a smart Alec, actually, to play it nicely. He's just kind of like a, you know, a disturber. Cypher. Yeah. And his foil is Tetsuo, who is this kid who kind of gets captured, a member of his biker gang, and they get separated. And the whole plot of them is coming back together, but you never ever see them hanging out together. Like, they get separated so early that the fact that they are friends seems sort of like skimmed right over. There are these secondary characters as well, Ryu and Kei, who belong to this sort of resistance force. You don't really know what they're resisting. They're badass. They're super cool, but you don't know really what their motivations are. You just know that they are against like the man, like the government forces, and the government is trying to has this program to build these like super soldier telekinetic humans or whatever, and they're after a MacGuffin. Anyways, the plot is so simple, but it's really about the visuals, the plotting, the action. It's just really excellently put together, and I felt really, really impressed having read through the first volume. Very, very enticed to keep reading it. But I just find it remarkable that this is the second case of a really important anime film based off of a manga series that I just hadn't read before. That being Nausicaa of the Valley of Wind, which I'd also just recently finished reading the second volume of.
I'm still in book four somewhere. I keep falling off it. Those are very dense.
They are very dense. But the first two volumes are not that dense, right? Like the action, there's a lot more in the graphic novels than there are in the film.
Yes, a lot of factions that I can't keep track of.
A lot of factions, but I feel like the plots of them are fairly simple. It's mostly like characters getting separated, coming back together. That's essentially the whole plot of a lot of these things. But still, there's a lot of nuance there. I'm really, really glad I get to read these series even in my older life, because these are some of my favorites from my youth. And I think if anyone listening hasn't had a chance to dig into these yet, well, what are you waiting for? These are like brilliant films, and their source material is even more brilliant. So really, get two for one. Akira and Nausicaa of the Valley of Wind, both created by the directors of the eventual films, were the authors and the illustrators of the original graphic art work. So really super impressive work from both of these kind of legendary giants of their craft. I didn't even say who the author is. Katsuhiro Otomo created Akira manga volume 1, which I just read. By the way, it comes out in 6 volumes. Originally printed in the year 2000 by Dark Horse Comics in North America. And unfortunately, it has been flipped from the Japanese right to left to the other side.
Dark Horse, of course.
To the left to right. So you see a lot of characters conspicuously being left-handed for some reason. Well, there you are. Anyways, great piece of work. I'm going to definitely continue reading them.
Very cool. Yeah, Akira has definitely been on my bucket list, along with Ghost in the Shell, which we were discussing last episode. But yeah.
I want to watch the movie again, so maybe you and I can have a rewatch comparison.
Yeah, well, speaking of classic anime that I managed to get off my bucket list, a couple of years ago I was watching a lot of the classic Miyazaki films like Totoro and Ponyo with my daughter. One that she wasn't able to get through at the time, she was a bit scared of, but I finally watched with her yesterday. That is Castle in the Sky. So I'd never seen this before. I know it is a very well-regarded one. I was surprised how much of this was... Basically, it was like sort of a classic adventure, like Indiana Jones or something. Like, you've got multiple parties all on this quest to get to this one place, and then you discover the power. That it's too much for any one person. We have to destroy it, basically. Very sort of... Not quite a fascist army, but like this military force that's like trying to track it down and want the power for themselves. You've got the pirates who are like very much the pirates of the Heart of Gold, it turns out. This one a little bit of treasure. They're in it for the right reasons, right? Yeah, it was a good... I'm still processing my thoughts on it, but it's a good... it was a fun classic adventure. It reminded me a lot of something like... It feels like Breath of the Wild, Zelda, is pulling on a lot of something like this. Like, there's a whole idea of lost technology, this sort of mysticism of the weird mix of sort of magic and technology, and the exploration elements and things in there. Not to mention like the floating islands, obviously. So it feels like that was definitely pulling a lot of inspiration there.
Yeah, this movie is probably my second favorite Ghibli film. And it, for a lot of those reasons that you mentioned, it carries over a lot of those kind of visual cues from my number one favorite, Nausicaä of the Valley of Wind. It's got this like very kind of like mid-20th century kind of industrial feeling to it, with the flying airships and like very kind of industrial machine age vehicles, and the costuming is obviously very kind of maybe early 20th century a European backdrop and feel to it, but the lost relics of an ancient time, except those ancient relics are highly technological old relics, connects it to Nausicaä very favorably as well.
And the fox squirrels, I think, yes, like, is literally the same creature.
It's literally a carryover as well. And I feel like the robot, maybe this is a bit of a spoiler, but later on in the film there's a robot that comes out, and its design, which you can actually see at the Ghibli Museum in Tokyo, in Western Tokyo, if you want to, a life-size version of it, I have. And its design, when it's fully outstretched, feels a lot like Nausicaä's glider. It feels like a very elegant shape of a flying machine. Very organic. Yeah, that's right. I really, really like that of that creature. I think I have a mini pewter figure of that robot back there. And yeah, I absolutely love it. I think you're spot on with your reference to, what is it, Tears of the Kingdom, right, and the floating islands. And I think a lot of Disney films have actually taken references. I think even like Brad Bird has admitted to this as much. Like, what was it? I think it was the Treasure Planet or something like that.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. A lot of things, just this kind of like industrial fantasy aesthetic have lifted a lot from this film. So, yeah. Can't say enough about Castle in the Sky, or Laputa Castle in the Sky, as it's called in Japanese.
I will say I was watching the English dub, mostly for my daughter's sake. I would normally watch the sub. A lot of the voice actors weren't really cutting it, I will say. Shiita, the main female character, is played by Anna Paquin, who has this really weird New Zealand accent that just doesn't really fit. James Vanderbeek, RIP, just a couple of weeks ago, is playing Pazu, the male lead, and it sounds a bit old. Like, it just doesn't match the sort of the kid. Both of them feel a little old and not quite match, I think. But I think I've often found with the dubs, something is lost in translation there, I think. So I definitely do want to rewatch the Japanese sub.
Yeah, can't say enough good things about that film. It was a good pick.
Excellent. Yeah, I've still got a couple more to watch. I think some of the older ones, like Princess Mononoke, I don't think my daughter's quite ready for that yet, but...
that one's a little violent.
Maybe Nausicaä, she's ready for, we'll see.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a sad moment at the end there. It's got some violence, too. Mm. Maybe, you know, it's not a bad thing to hold off some of those till age 10 or older.
Yeah, perhaps. But like, could it make an impact while they they'll remember it, for sure.
kick-ass princesses are a great thing.
Absolutely. Excellent. Well, I think that about wraps it for today's podcast. So if you have any questions or comments on today's games or anime, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. You can catch our episodes that we put out on YouTube in video form, or if you want to check out our older back catalog, our very earliest episodes are only available in audio form. Go check those out on a podcatcher of your choosing. You can follow me on Blue Sky. That's MarkYuasa. Bsky.social. And yourself, Daniel?
You can find me at Board Game Feast, also on Blue Sky, and the Omni Gamers Club account there as well. And you can catch both of us at TCTC, Terminal City Tabletop Convention, coming up in just a couple of weeks. And we still have a couple of tickets to give away if you're in Vancouver. You can email us with TCTC in the subject line, and we'll enter you to win a couple of tickets. So.
Yeah, and if you have sent us a submission already, we apologize. I've been a little bit delinquent and haven't checked them yet. So you got your chance still.
Yep. Excellent. Well, I look forward to seeing you and lots of other friends there. In the meantime, remember to have a balanced diet of games.
Cheers.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.